The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the Yes And moment in your work and in your life. Yes And is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is George Anders. George is the author of 5 books, including New York Times bestseller Perfect Enough. He has been a staff writer for The Wall Street Journal, Fast Company, and Bloomberg View. In 1997, he shared a Pulitzer Prize for national reporting. His latest book is called You Can Do Anything, The Surprising Power of a Useless Liberal Arts Education. George Anders, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be on the show.
I had to write another big check to Skidmore College the other day as my son Nick is entering a sophomore year. And this is a classic liberal arts college where Nick is a double major in English and theater. And I know a good segment of the population would likely say that I might be wasting my money, but that's not what you think.
It's going to work out. It may not work out in a straight line, but that's actually something to take pride in. And one of the things I do in the book is follow some of the really interesting zigzag journeys that people take. They'll start out with a part-time job here and an internship there, and I've got one guy who bounced around and, you know, 6 different things before he ended up working for the State Department and became a personal assistant to John Kerry, and it was quite cool. But turn the clock back a couple of years earlier, and what was he doing? He was putting up free content in Persian on some website with astronomy pictures from, you know, various lunar missions. And you go, wait, how does translating stuff into Persian for an astronomy site help you get a job in the State Department? And the answer is you just keep trying. And one of the things I love about a liberal arts education is it teaches people to be resilient, and it teaches people to put together these informal networks of folks that are rooting for you and people who have seen your work, and it gives you a lot of flexibility. But one of the things we forget is we always think college is going to provide security, and it can, but not everything lasts forever. And what's sometimes much more valuable is that ability to gain flexibility so that when the world changes, you've still got skills and you've still got contacts that will help you get a good job.
Right. And you point out that there's this narrative that's developed, I guess, in recent times. There's a stigma, right? And I'm quoting from the book. You say, quote, "The horrifying stereotype of liberal arts majors ending up in green smocks pouring coffee at Starbucks has become a trope that won't go away." And that's certainly the jokes we get when we, you know, talk to the audience at Second City and talk about college is, you know, are you wasting your time on a poetry, you know, major or whatever. But that's a stigma that really exists in our culture.
Yes, it is. And it's unfortunate because we need creative people. That they're, you know, if our worry is what are the machines going to do, the machines are not going to be able to tell good jokes. They've been trying it for 50 years and they're
right.
Not getting any better. And poor Alexa just can't make me laugh except when it's so bad that it's pitiful. So, yes, we still need human wit and human ingenuity. And one of the reasons I wrote the book was to try and knock that trope off its pedestal.
Yeah, and you bring up a really important area, and we always talk about this at Second City where we talk about humans versus robots. And you point out McKinsey researchers say that 45% of workplace tasks in modern society are at risk of being automated. And if that's the case, I would think that the attributes that are going to be needed for jobs are ones that are especially human.
Totally. We're in complete agreement on that. And in fact, since I now have an Uber driver story, that this is now the ultimate proof point of any argument, is it's true for an Uber driver. But one of my Uber rides, I asked the guy, so what did you used to do? And he says, I used to be a semiconductor design engineer, and I figured out where all the transistors and resistors and stuff would go. And there's now a software program that does it faster than I can and never makes mistakes. And that's why I'm now driving a car. And, you know, we get kind of misled sometimes if we think that a technical degree guarantees you 40 years of employment. And in fact, just as you say, this ability to come up with uniquely human jobs, to be someone who brings wit and warmth into the environment, those are valuable skills, whether you're in sales, whether you're in the front lines of healthcare, all kinds of fields, teaching, that ability to make the human connection. You can get paid a lot of money for that, and you can get a lot of job security from it, too.
You know, we've talked a lot about on this podcast of the idea that creativity is not magic. And I'd suggest that some of the blame here about the sort of Starbucks trope also comes from the creative class that has attempted to sort of mythologize what they do. You know, these creative directors at advertising agencies who make millions and millions of dollars as if only one person with a special skill can make that kind of stuff happen. When in fact, our belief where I work is that actually all human beings have really interesting stuff inside them. A lot of it gets educated out, but a very rich sort of college experience has ability to turn. I always feel like it's translators, right? Being able to translate your experiences, translate numbers into meaningful narratives for people. And I think a good liberal arts education is constantly teaching you the ability to translate.
You framed it really nicely. And in fact, when you talk about the spillover benefits of what we do in college, one of my favorite stories in the book involves a really successful salesperson who does job-related ads for Monster. And she says in college, one of the things she did was deliver pizzas. Hmm. And she said, you have never dealt with anyone as angry as a person who thinks they got the wrong toppings on their pizza. And what she learned at age 19 is totally useful when it comes to, well, here's what you got, a $100,000 ad deal, and you got kind of what you bargained on and kind of what you didn't, and we're going to need to figure out where we go from here. And those same skills take her forward. But if you're a very mechanical person who just locks in and says, well, I'm reading the contract, we gave what's in the contract, you lose a customer. And if you've got that ability to roll with people, which you do tend to pick up in the kinds of seminars and, you know, free reading exercises that you'll get in a liberal arts education, you're just going to be able to go with the flow a whole lot better.
So you talk about in the book that, quote, our world needs people who color outside the lines. So when you're talking about that, what is it inside a liberal arts education that promotes that kind of alternative critical thinking?
Well, there are two things. I mean, one, a lot of the time you don't really know the right answer. It's not like going and sitting and working an equation and then you solve for X and that is definitely what X is. And whether it's, you know, sociology questions of why do people end up in prison and does prison make them any better or does it just make them worse? You know, these are questions that you can debate from a lot of different directions. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of education gets you very comfortable with uncertainty, with what isn't known, with building up a hypothesis and a theory that you maybe think is there's a 70% chance that it's right. It's more likely right than not, but you're not totally certain of it. And that flexibility and fluidity turns out to be really useful because a lot of the big questions that people encounter in business, you don't totally know for sure. I remember talking with one CEO, Dave Elkington of Inside Sales, and he says anytime he has a problem where he doesn't even know quite how to solve it, he'll turn it over to a liberal arts major because he figures they'll find solutions that he wasn't thinking of. And he hires a lot of them.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, one of the things that we hear a lot about is the sort of the threat on college campuses right now in terms of there's all this free speech debate, and this goes both to the right and the left. But, I've always felt that it's this ability to sort of crawl in someone's viewpoint that's not your own and confront ideas that are really thorny and complicated is exactly the kind of practice that should exist on our college campuses that we don't need to shield our young people from because it's not like they have that shield when they enter into the, you know, the working world.
Yeah, and let me just take that one step further, yeah. That if you look at psychological research, the best way to get someone to change their mind is not to tell them that they're wrong and to berate them for the foolishness of their point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. The best thing to do is to ask them to explain it to you more slowly and in more detail. Mm-hmm. And that's when people realize, wait, I'm actually making an argument that's crazy. But you have to give people room to explain themselves and sometimes they might convince you. Sometimes they might just bring out all sorts of new facts that you hadn't thought of. And other times it becomes obvious as they take you through their unusual views. I mean, I'll do this with the Lyndon LaRouche people all the time. Anytime I pass by them at a street setting, I'll ask them, what's the deal with the Fed and money and that sort of thing. And 5-10 questions in, they're having a hard time keeping their illusions going. But you learn that in a college setting where there's not an obvious scorecard of which ideas are right and which ideas are wrong, and you have to test them all out. And that ability to test out ideas will take you into interesting new discoveries, and it'll also safeguard you against stuff that's nonsense. And I think sometimes we can be too skeptical, but we can also be too credulous. And a good college education will help you on both those dimensions.
I enjoyed, too, when you wrote, quote, "It's time to help meandering regain its good name." We had Adam Grant on the podcast, who, of course, has done research in this area about the benefits of procrastination, allowing you to sort of like play with an idea without doing anything. And the research shows that that's a really valuable exercise.
Yeah, and I think sometimes we have to sort of just loosen the gears a little bit and let things slide around and see if maybe there's a better configuration. And stuff that you pick up in one setting ends up being useful in another. That it happens so often. I tell the story of one international relations major who was having a terrible time after she graduated, and none of the consulting firms wanted to hire her because she just seemed too flighty, and she'd done a project in Ecuador, and she'd done a project in South Africa, and she'd done a little video documentary in Indonesia, and thinking, do you have any focus to your life? And ultimately, she ended up doing spectacularly well running an internationalization program for WikiHow, which is one of the big online answer sites. And they needed someone who could make sense of 18 different countries they wanted to go into and hire people to translate the site into Dutch and figure out how to get the thing running in Spanish and work up a Thai version of it. And you actually need someone who jumps around from subject to subject like that. And people who are very linear just don't thrive in those kind of jobs. So there is room for people who hop around a lot.
Yeah, one of your story, you don't normally think about people getting into sort of data, that's going to be your classic liberal arts profile. But I really was interested when you talked about the woman who worked at OpenTable. And I use OpenTable all the time, and I didn't really consider, of course, they've got this like data side, but it's like the numbers alone don't do much for you, because you need the individual to sort of bring that to the people.
Well, and the other thing is, everyone who runs a restaurant, particularly a high-end restaurant, they've got a ton of opinions. They've got a way to do everything. They've got an idea of what's a good cream sauce and what's a bad cream sauce. They've got an idea of how you fold a napkin. And you can't just come into these people and say, I've calculated something that will give you a 14% higher yield on Tuesdays after 9 p.m. And they go, you have no idea how I run my restaurant.
Right.
So the fun to me of how the LinkedIn analytics, OpenTable analytics team works is they've got 8 or 9 people that run the numbers, but they've got more than 100 people who are these evangelists for change, and they go out with their iPods, and they sit down, and they will sort of share, here's some findings, and by the way, how's the restaurant going? Where are you're getting your lettuces? Well, what new things have you tried for dessert? And you get comfortable with the person running the restaurant, and it may take 40 minutes of talking food for them to want to hear 10 minutes of what's going on with the data. But that's when they bring out the iPad, and that's when they share the information. And it's a beautiful illustration of how numbers and telling stories have to be married together, that you can't succeed just by, shoving printout after printout in people's face. So these are great jobs. They pay $80,000, $90,000, $100,000 a year. You get to travel. You get to spend a lot of time in good restaurants. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the people who are doing them are English majors, psych majors, sociology majors. That ability to understand another person's point of view just becomes really valuable.
We're involved with a project with the Behavioral Science Group at the University of Chicago, and they've shared a lot of insights with us in the area of, because we teach a lot about being others focused. And this is so important because we as human beings wildly overestimate our ability to perceive what's going on with other people. And you write in the book, quote, "It all comes back to one of the essentials of critical thinking in the real world, being mindful of other people's perspectives." And that's not easy. It needs practice.
Yes, it does. And people can start to get rigid and you assume that you're right and everyone's wrong. And that can be very narrowing. So this Some of the people who are in the book have almost a childlike dimension to life, and that's not a deficit. That can actually be quite handy. And, you know, there's no stage in our life when we're more curious than, you know, when we're 5 or 6, and we have questions about everything, and we want to know why. And you'd made reference earlier to the idea that some of this gets educated out of people because they're supposed to learn to write the 5-paragraph essay and always do certain things in the conclusion. And I just find it refreshing to come across people who are still willing just to make it up as they go along and bring a little bit of originality into the mix.
Well, that's the difference, right? I mean, I'm very lucky in my educational experience because I went to Neutra High School, and I had majority great teachers who allowed for a lot of expression. And all of them said the same thing to me because they knew I was sort of a creative individual. They're like, you're going to love college, which was absolutely true. And in part, what I loved about it was that sort of freedom to open up my own narrative, share my story, hear other people's stories, and begin to build on that narrative. And actually, you go into storytelling you write, quote, companies historically have undervalued the importance of getting their stories right. So a liberal arts education steeps you in the kind of storytelling that I guess most people wouldn't see that as a translation to go into big business, but it absolutely is.
Yeah, and especially now that we've got so many industries in tremendous flux, and, you know, if you're going to run a bus route and drive the number 28 bus from, you know, one end of town to the other, your purpose is pretty clear.
Yeah.
But there are an awful lot of fields now that are springing up where you go, wow, we didn't even have companies like that before, or we didn't have projects like that before. And, you know, whether it's virtual reality, whether it's, you know, some of the things we can do in digital media, new forms of transportation. There aren't a lot of industries where you say it's just going to be the same as when your dad worked here.
Mm-hmm.
And you need people who can catch the new patterns and figure out sense and purpose and how you're going to be valuable and connect with the public. And that's not going to come just from doing more of the same.
I told my friend Jennifer Ocker, who teaches at Stanford, you mentioned in the book, and so I promised her I was going to name drop her during our conversation. And she said a thing last time I was on campus at Stanford that many stories are tactical, but she says great stories are strategic. And I think when you sort of get underneath that a story is just not a tale told, that there's all different kinds of stories, that in college in particular, you learn how to inject those stories to be of use to you, right? It could be persuading someone to buy your product, or it can be, you know, how to get your product noticed. But all the different ways in which a story takes over is really something that is valuable.
And in fact, just building on that point, that I share the story of one of Facebook's most successful people on their advertising business development team. And you look at that, and good heavens, there's now like $30 billion a year of ads that are sold on Facebook. And for traditional online businesses that are used to being in the yellow pages and, you know, being in the newspaper, this notion of all we're buying is pixels, I can't even see my ad a lot of the time, is disconcerting. And she's got this wonderful story of a plumber in New England who puts up Facebook ads Sunday morning after a cold snap when everyone's pipes are frozen and says, frozen pipes, call me. Mm-hmm. And he gets all the business he needs. And, you know, when it's 7:30 in the morning and you turn on the sink and the sink doesn't go on and you just got this gasping sound and you realize everything's frozen, what do? You pick up your phone and you start, you know, posting the woe is me status update, or you check to see what your friends are, and boom, comes his ad, and there you go. But she now tells this story at sales conferences all around the country and gets paid very good money for doing it because it's so engaging and personal. And, you know, she has other stories about people who bake pies and cupcakes, and geo-target folks within half a mile of their pie store, and pretty soon everyone's magnetically drawn off the sidewalk into the pie store. And it's this ability to go, what's the story that will get everyone to understand, here's how my product works, and here's how it could make my life better. And that's a gift. And that's, you know, we absorb statistics, but we change our minds because of stories.
And it doesn't just stop at the 4 years, hopefully 4 years, not more, that you're in college. And I know this from working at Second City, where we have this incredible alumni network, right? So when I was coming up in the work, the great late director Harold Ramis would give notes on productions and take meetings with you. And you get to talk to the more modern people like Stephen Colbert and Tina Fey. They hire people onto their show who also worked at Second City. And that's the same thing at a college. And you write, quote, your greatest allies, thousands of alumni from your college.
Yeah, and I think there's an apprehension about networking because the assumption is, oh, this means hanging out with people that I don't really like, trying to get to do things they don't really want to do. And if that's how you approach networking, yes, it'll be very frustrating. But I think of it much more as just spending time with people you enjoy. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times there'll be people who are a little farther along than you are in the world because you learn from them and because there are all these really nice pointers that they'll share. And exactly as you described, you've got mentors like that who've been really successful. And colleges are a great place to meet that. I mean, I find if I get an email out of the blue from someone and they went to the same school I did, I'll usually make time for them. If they went to the same school I did and they profess to have read one of my books, they've got 20 minutes of my time anytime they want. Uh-huh. And do a little prep, figure out what people do, understand their world, and reach out. And it's in everyone's interest to make the college community thrive. I mean, the prestige kind of comes back to you. And I think there's very much a heritage of giving on to the next class, the next generation. So one of the things I argue in the book is that colleges spend way too much time cultivating people from the class of 1962 because they can write giant checks. Mm-hmm. And what they should really be doing is opening more pathways to the class of 2015 because those are the people who have just figured out how to get an entry-level job. It's exactly what a current student, a senior, or a recent graduate needs. And hopefully that'll change. And I lay out some ways that you can get more connected with the recent alums who actually know how to get the job now. And the more of that happens, the better.
You have a nice note in there, too, where you say you need to say yes a lot. That is just something you need to do.
It's surprising how much better life goes. And we can all think of things that can go wrong. And one of the really good bits of career advice I got early on was start thinking about what can go right. Mm-hmm. And often that's where the big surprises are.
Yeah, 100%. All right, yeah, I took a quote out of your book when I was doing my notes for our interview, and then I just decided to put it up on LinkedIn and see what the response would be. And you'd be happy to know this is like my most liked or whatever it happens on LinkedIn, you know, viewed, appreciated.
That's awesome. Tell me more about it.
So this is your quote. Quote, every leadership question is really about communication, and every communication question is actually a leadership question in disguise.
I'll stand by it, that when you think about how do we communicate, it's not just sharing factual information. It's trying to bring people around to a new point of view, open their minds to something, get to do something. And when you think about the people who get promoted two or three levels and then they work really hard, they come in early, they leave late, they always turn in stuff on time, but there's a ceiling and they don't go any higher. Mm-hmm. A lot of times it's because they aren't effective communicators. They're the ones who get nervous and brittle in a meeting. They're the ones who can't address a crowd. And the people who can do that, that is so much a big part of leadership. And you can see it in religious organizations and civic organizations, the kind of movements that have swept society, whether it's Teach for America or an awful lot of the most effective things on the web. Communication and leadership just are braided together.
Yeah, so we talked about this at Second City, and our corporate division does upwards of 400 to 500 engagements a year. We average with Fortune 1000 companies, bringing in team building and creativity and innovation. But really, if you wanted to just use one word for all of it, it is all communication. And sometimes mm-hmm. that communication is to an audience, and sometimes it's to the person sitting across from you. Sometimes you're higher in status or you're lower in status. In the sort of theatrical world that we live in, we have to model all those different roles. And when you're improvising, it's not like you can just stay in your high-status role. If someone comes in with higher status, that's a terrible improv move, is to match them or try to go above them. Sometimes you have to go underneath. And so we sort of figured out a while ago, oh, wait a sec, if the business world could just have practice in all the different elements of communication, perhaps they would communicate better, and then maybe work would be better.
I love that formula. I think that's a passport to just a better work experience. And I found almost every argument breaks down to a failure in communication. You know, I didn't understand that you weren't going to meet me at the train station. You know, I thought when you said that you'd make good on this that you really meant it. And no, it was a conditional offer, or I didn't think I was making a promise. So, yeah, I mean, good communication brings good outcomes, but communication is probably at the heart of just about every disagreement.
I remember my son Nick in his freshman year at Skidmore, he loved all his classes. He had one class that he was having trouble with, like, communicating with the teacher, understanding sort of what the teacher wanted. And I actually said, have you asked the teacher what she wants? Like, directly? And he's like, no. And I'm like, do that. Like people – and I say this is not flippant suggestion. People don't necessarily do that all the time because they don't think they're supposed to. And you will find often that someone's like, great, you actually want to know what I want? Here's what I want. And actually it opened up the whole door for him, and he did well in the class.
Or you presume that the answer is going to be incredibly negative.
Right.
And a lot of times other people want to get to a successful outcome too. And all of a sudden you discover you can work together. I remember interviewing someone who worked with various gangs in Los Angeles and was trying to get gang members back on track. And one of the things he would do would take people from different gangs and put them in the same kitchen washing dishes side by side. And he said, you know, once he got past the first moment's tension of, oh, my God, who are you? You can't hate up close. And there ends up being rapport. And when there was a death in one of the families, one of them crossed gang lines and came over to just commiserate with the other family.
Wow.
But, the more we can do to communicate, the better. And I always worry that so much of college is writing papers alone. And I just think, particularly in this world where we're trying to outmaneuver the machines, the more we can collaborate, the more we can share ideas back and forth, the more we can work in groups, the more effective we are.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you for your yes and story in a moment, but I want to, one more question I want to talk to you about is this idea around mentorship, which touches on what you were sort of just saying. And I think there was a study in the book that talked about students who had faculty mentors had a much higher chance of getting a better than average first job after graduation. That's kind of amazing. So what's going on behind that?
So it can work in two different ways. I mean, one, some faculty just have incredible personal networks, and they'll introduce you to a friend of theirs who's got a job somewhere. And we've seen that a lot in the engineering fields. If you want to get a job in the oil industry, chat up your petroleum engineering professor, and he or she's talking to Exxon and Chevron and all the other big oil companies. But there's room for that to be happening in the liberal arts, too. One of the professors that really impressed me at Drew College, and she'd worked in healthcare, she'd worked in theater, she'd worked in politics, and any time a student would come in and go, you know, what do I do now? She'd go, here's someone you should talk to. And she got one of them set up with the art department at a big bank, and, you know, as an art major, what do I do with an art degree? Well, you know what, you can help J.P. Morgan buy its art collection, and that would be rather a fun way to spend the day. So that's one big role for professors. And then the other is just to boost students' self-confidence,
right,
and make them feel they belong there and that life's going to work out. And if you can bring an upbeat personality, a lot more doors open for you.
Yeah, well, it gives you practice in easy communication with someone in a higher status position. So, you know, impressing the boss or whatever. You've got to be able to feel comfortable that you can have those kinds of conversations. And not everyone can do that.
Yeah, and being witty and being yourself around the boss, too,
yeah,
and not sort of getting such stage fright that you come across as someone who doesn't feel they belong.
Yeah, because people want to work with people who they like and they want to be with.
Yeah. Yes, they do.
Okay, so we always close the podcast with a yes and story. And so in improvisation, two people making a scene out of nothing, they get nowhere when they say no, and they can't just say yes. They have to say yes and. They have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten the scene. Do you have a yes and story for us?
I do, yeah, and in fact, this goes back to, we're going to want to retake
this. Yeah, with the train, that's fine.
Yes, the train's going to make it too exciting. Mm-hmm. We may have escaped the, let's try it. Are you getting background noise or not?
No, I'm okay.
Okay, let's give it a shot. So I do have a story for you, and this goes back to a few years after college. I was working in London at the time, and I felt I had a terribly important job. I didn't really, but I was dating this wonderful woman who said, hey, would you like to go to India? And my first thought was, you know, I've got way too many demands on my time to take 3 or 4 weeks off to go to India. And then I realized, you know, I can get other bosses in my life. This is really a pretty magical relationship, and why not jump into the unknown and see where it goes? And my yes and was, yes, let's go to Nepal, too, because I like hiking in mountains, and I always wanted to see the biggest mountains in the world. And we ended up going for a month, and somewhere along the way I proposed to her, and she didn't quite say yes, but she certainly didn't say no. And a while later, we actually did get engaged, and we've been married for more than 20 years now. So I couldn't ask for a better proof of the value of saying yes and. And I love the way you guys use that as a prompt, too. I think that takes you into interesting places.
That's a great yes and story, and what a great way to end. The book is called You Can Do Anything. George Anders, thanks for coming on the show.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for the chance to do it.
Well, I've been working in a coal mine, going down, down. Working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down. Working in a coal mine, going down, down. Working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down. 5 o'clock in the morning, I'm up before the sun. When my work day is over, I'm tired for having fun. I've been working in a coal mine, going down, down. Working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down. Working in a coal mine, going down, down. Working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down.
Lord, I am so tired. How long can this go on?
Well, I've been working.
Working, going, about to slip down. Working, going, about to slip down. Working, going.